Welcome to this Essential Knowledge Update podcast from the Royal College of General Practitioners. My name is Sally Higginbottom, and today I'm interviewing Dr. Kevin Barrett, a GP partner in Hertfordshire and RCGP clinical lead. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Sally.
So what are we talking about today?
So today we're talking about NICE NG136, which is the module that's described as Hypertension in Adults, Diagnosis and Management. It's been around for a while, but it was last updated in August 2019.
And how do you think about hypertension?
I think for me, hypertension is a combination of processes. There's not just one single part of it. You've got a combination of things. You've got normal aging processes, as the blood vessels get stiffer. Genetics play a part as well. So we know family history is important with it. You've got hormonal factors, so those produced by the kidneys in particular. And then the impact that the heart has as well. We know that as the blood pressure rises, the heart has to work harder to cope, and this results in positive feedback loops that go round. So a combination of factors.
And when you're describing hypertension to patients, do you have any good models you use, any analogies?
The one I quite like is a very practical thing. My dad was an engineer, so he always talked to us about real-world examples of things. And I like the central heating analogy. So you've got a boiler, which is the heart pumping blood around a system. And as you get older, it becomes stiffer and more scaled up. And you've got the radiators, which are the organs. And you can expand that into leaks and problems.
I think that's a nice analogy. Yeah, the other one I heard was a lot of patients will understand that if you have the pressures on your tyres too high, it wears them out faster. And the same might apply to blood vessels. It's good to have some explanations, isn't it? It can make it feel a bit more real for people.
Definitely.
When someone's found to have an initial high blood pressure reading, what else do you want to check?
NICE NG136 describes a very clear process for doing this. Obviously, it's difficult these days with remote consultations that we're doing more and more of. However, one is supposed to get a recording of the blood pressure in both arms. And if you get a 50 millimeter mercury difference or greater, then you take action on that. And then NICE also recommends that you don't act upon a single reading taken in one consultation. And you should do a second or even a third reading later in the consultation if there is a significant difference. Then talks about ambulatory blood pressure readings, or a series of home readings, and you can carry those out if the blood pressure readings are between 140 over 90 and 180 over 120. But if you get a very high reading, which we don't see very often, but I can remember a few examples where you get readings of greater than 180 over 120, and these require action. And NICE does divide these into three different groups. Obviously, we get concerned about the patients who need medically urgent same-day assessment. And those are the obvious ones who have chest pain, confusion, heart failure, or appear uremic because of kidney problems. Or if you look in their eyes, they have retinal hemorrhage or papilledema. And papilledema and significant retinal hemorrhages with a very high blood pressure is associated with a thing called accelerated or malignant hypertension. And these are terms we don't often hear these days, but we do still see them. And then obviously we need to think about those rare but important red flags like pheochromocytomas. But if you see a patient with very labile blood pressure readings or high blood pressure readings associated with abdominal pain or severe headaches, then that's always something to bear in mind as well. The second group of patients who have very high readings of greater than 180 over 120 are those that have signs of target organ damage. And those are the ones that require antihypertensive treatment the same day. And the end organ damage includes kidneys, so you look for proteinuria, again, look in the eyes for hypertensive retinopathy, or even ECG changes. And again, those things can be challenging in a remote consultation, but there should be ways around that. And then finally, if everything's normal, but the patient's blood pressure readings are still greater than 180 over 120, then just arrange routine bloods and an ECG, and then see the patient again in a week's time. Final bit that NICE tells us with patients with newly diagnosed or newly detected hypertension is to do a cardiovascular risk assessment. And typically in general practice, we do that with calculating Q risk. As well as that, they should also have a urine test for protein and blood, an ECG, as we mentioned before, and then cholesterol levels, HbA1c. And then you should also look in their eyes.
So there's quite a lot to do when you get one high reading. And particularly now we're doing so much work remotely, it's going to be interesting to see how we develop systems to cope with that. Why are the thresholds for clinic readings different to those for home or ambulatory readings?
We know actually from personal experience, as well as from the patients that we see, that most patients, actually the readings in surgeries or in outpatient clinics are higher just because of the stress that goes on. It's an unusual situation. They're worried about things. Often at home, they're more relaxed as well. NICE uses a 5 millimeter reading difference between clinic readings and home readings. A surgery reading is 5 millimetres higher than a home reading or an ambulatory reading as well. Occasionally get the opposite, actually. We get a thing called masked hypertension, where the readings at home are actually higher than those in the surgery. And that's just something to bear in mind. I've never seen that myself, that I'm aware of. But it's just something that NICE talks about. So we should think about that too.
If one of the readings, systolic or diastolic, is over the threshold, but the other isn't, what do we do? Which is more important?
So NICE says that the isolated systolic hypertension is actually more important than the diastolic readings. So if you see a systolic that's greater than 160, you should act upon that, even if the diastolic is normal. There are reasons why that can happen, and having a listen to the heart for heart murmurs, again, because of the valve problems, that can pick that up sometimes. So again, that's just part of the general assessment. But the systolic reading is the one that NICE is particularly worried about and focused on.
So looking at the guidance, broadly speaking, stage one hypertension with a systolic of 135 to 149, we use a risk assessment. So when we treat if the risk is over 10% or if the patient's over 80. But for stage two with a blood pressure of 150 over 95, we offer treatment to everyone. Is that right?
It is. And this is something that I sometimes get tied up in knots before, because the previous guidance was slightly simpler than this back when I started as a GP. So Q risk is something that's recommended by NICE because it's widely used and it's easy to calculate with the information we have in our clinical systems. So stage one hypertension, there's a clinic readings rather than home readings of 140 to 159 over 90 to 99. And this group should only be treated if they have a Q risk of greater than 10%, or end organ damage, or renal disease, or diabetes, or they're over 80. So that those four groups come into it. If they're aged under 60 with stage one hypertension and a risk of less than 10%, then NICE says you should discuss drug treatment in addition to lifestyle advice. But it's not mandated that they are always treated with medication. Stage two hypertension, which is blood pressure readings greater than 160 or 100, they should almost always be treated with medication as well as lifestyle advice. So 160 over 100, treat absolutely all of them. And those lower readings, again, work out and see if there are other risk factors before you start treating them.
And why the 10% threshold? What's magic about that?
NICE looked at that because they look at the cost effectiveness of treatments, and even though the drug treatments for hypertension are relatively cheap, there's little evidence of benefit in treating patients with a 10-year cardiovascular risk less than 5%. And you should always talk about the patient when it approaches 10% and have that discussion with the patient about their individual risk factors and their individual preferences, and again, lifestyle factors come into that.
Okay, and what's different in the under 40s?
So hypertension in the under 40s is less common. It's unlikely to be due to just the straightforward normal aging process, even though it can be in some cases. Secondary causes of hypertension are much more likely, and NICE recommends that everyone is referred for specialist assessment if they're found to have persistent hypertension before the age of 40.
Okay. So do you do standing blood pressures? And how long do people have to stand up before you check?
So standing blood pressure readings are recommended for patients with type 2 diabetes, or with those with symptoms of postural hypotension, or those aged over 80. And again, you should base the treatment targets upon their standing reading. Now, NICE doesn't specify how long one needs to stand for, but I had a look around, and the Royal College of Physicians recommends standing for 3 minutes, which is quite a long time when you've got a 10-minute consultation as well. But that's the guidance that's recommended. And sometimes they say if the blood pressure is still falling after 3 minutes, you check it at 1 minute and check it at 3 minutes and it's still dropping, then you continue to check it after that, which can take up quite a lot of time.
This was news to me, really. I know that people's blood pressure doesn't drop as soon as they stand up, but it's surprising that people might be experiencing orthostatic hypotension minutes after they've stood up, to me. That was new.
Absolutely. I think, you know, empirically, one always thinks that blood pressure drops straight away as soon as you stand up, but it can certainly continue to drop for several minutes.
It's important. And how did the blood pressure targets change with age?
Again, years and years ago, you used to have targets of blood pressure that were age minus 120 and all those complicated formulas, but you know, NICE has got rid of that a long time ago, and now they just have the cutoff point of 80. So, and that's the target increases from 140 over 80 to 150 over 90. But again, you should use your clinical judgment in patients who are frail or have got multimorbidity. So 80 is not an absolute marker, and again, obviously reduce those readings by 5 millimeters when they're done at home or ambulatory readings as well. And that's really because the risk of postural hypertension, and we know that goes up the older you get because of the age-related changes that happen.
So we relax the target slightly in older or frailer patients.
Absolutely.
And do you routinely check blood pressure in both arms?
I didn't used to, but certainly that's one of my learning points from reading the guidance again. And again, we know there are some rare conditions that can make a difference. And there's increasing evidence that a difference in the two arms can indicate more significant underlying disease. So I will do.
And thinking about target organ damage, and I suggest we check the kidneys, eyes and heart with an ECG, which is fairly straightforward, but I'm not terribly confident in identifying hypertensive retinopathy, particularly in older people with small pupils, and I wouldn't routinely do that. I just suggest they see an optician. What do you do?
And I do struggle with it. I will have will try and have a look, and again, just to increase my experience, but I do definitely struggle with that as well. And again, with COVID, it's quite difficult to do that remotely. So I agree that actually a visit to an optician is usually worthwhile, and nice talks about retinopathy so often in the guidance that I think it's one of those things that we should start doing, and hopefully our local opticians will be happy to do that for us.
So how do things change if a patient has diabetes?
Again, this is something that they used to make a differentiation in previous iterations of the NICE guidance, but the current guidance doesn't make any differentiation between adults with diabetes and those without, unless the patient has chronic kidney disease as well as diabetes. So in that group, so patients with CKD and diabetes, the target blood pressure reading that you're aiming for is 130 over 80, so it is lower for that group, but that group only.
Bedtime dosing has become a thing recently. What's that about?
The NICE guidance recommends once daily dosing to improve compliance, but doesn't specify this should be in the morning or at bedtime. There was a trial that's published in the European Heart Journal in October 2019, the Hygieia trial, and that looked at 19,000 patients over 6 years and followed them up, and showed that the incidence of heart attacks, strokes and death was about half if they took their antihypertensive medication at night time rather than in the morning. And that group also showed better blood pressure control overall as well. So this is something that we should start. It's not in NICE, not in the current iteration of NICE, but it may well be introduced in future versions of it. It's a simple thing to do. The benefits are there. However, you need to balance those benefits against the risks of poorer compliance, because lots of patients just take all the medication in the morning. And again, you need to be aware of postural hypertension overnight, particularly when patients get up to go to the loo and they might fall down the stairs or worse. And so again, it's just having that judgment with the patient in front of you.
Yes, it just seems like such an easy win, doesn't it? If those results are replicated, it was quite striking how effective that might be.
Definitely.
So what's your first line treatment?
When you've asked that, the first thing that comes to your mind is our prescriptions and prescribing and medication. But actually, lifestyle changes are actually the first line treatment that we should recommend to our patients. We shouldn't just reach for the prescription pad. Obviously, it's not possible for everybody because of their personal circumstances, but this is a great opportunity to have a positive impact on the patient's physical and emotional well-being. And those lifestyle changes don't have to be expensive or time-consuming. Simple things like being more active for just 10 minutes per day, walking more, getting the bike out of the shed, those sorts of things can make a huge difference. And making small diet changes are important as well. So lots more vegetables, for example, and cutting down on processed foods are just suggestions that we make. There are ways we can do this, and some areas have social prescribers or physical activity prescribers, exercise prescribers, and we refer patients to those groups. There are voluntary things. Personally, I'm a huge fan of parkrun, and I try and mention this to almost every patient I see, which my friends laugh at me about.
Parkrun is fantastic, isn't it? And it can start with park walk for people who aren't quite up for running at the start as well.
Yes, definitely. You don't have to be a runner to do parkrun.
Are there any particular treatment synergies that are worth considering when you're prescribing?
There is a little bit of complication here with NICE. And again, I do tend to kind of pick up the guidance with these groups as well. The general rule is that the ACE inhibitors are first line for patients aged under 55, and that even includes women of childbearing age. But the exceptions that NICE talk about are patients with Black African or Afro-Caribbean origin, where an ARB is recommended rather than an ACE inhibitor. And then once you're over 55, then calcium channel blockers are recommended first line for people that don't have diabetes. And then also you think about patients with heart failure, so you might actually go for thiazide-like diuretic in that group. And then patients with prostatic symptoms, again, if their blood pressure is only borderline, then you may actually decide to go for an alpha blocker too. So there is scope for tailoring the medication according to the requirements of the patient with their other conditions as well. And obviously you'd always go for lifestyle measures in the first place.
The other lifestyle thing that's worth mentioning is, of course, alcohol, isn't it, which can be a big contributor.
Yes, very much.
What changes will you make in your management based on this module?
I think the three things I learned from this are to check the blood pressure in both arms, to tailor the blood pressure target to the individual, just looking at that rather than just relying upon what pops up on our little cough windows on the system. And then also to actually just use more and more home blood pressure readings, because we know that patients who check their own blood pressure at home on the whole have better control and are actually more engaged with the treatment than patients who just take the tablets and carry on with doing what else they were doing before.
That's really helpful. Thank you, Kevin, for your time, and thank you for listening to this podcast from the Royal College of General Practitioners. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you, Sally.